The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 362, The Ordeal of Josephine Lyon Smith Fisher, a paper by Todd Compton, with comments by Lee Wharton. The chair is Claire Barris. This session is 60 minutes, and it's recorded on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Site 2 will be blank.
Either of those, go ahead and go to the desk and purchase one. Todd Compton, probably most of you are aware of Todd, but let me give you just a little bit about Todd, including Mormon-related journals and other journals. And he most significantly has published a recent book called In Sacred Loneliness. This won the best book of 1997 from the Mormon History Association. So we'll turn the time over to Todd, after which we'll hear from Lee Wharton, who, I hope I have this right, Lee, is the assistant director at the University of Utah Law Library. Okay, great. So we'll turn the time over to Todd now.
Okay, I approach this topic with just a little trepidation, in as much as I'm coming down in chronology here a little bit. The other women I wrote about, they were all Nauvoo veterans, and Josephine lived a good many years into our century, and I'm informed that there are actually people here today who knew her. So I hope if I make any mistakes that you'll come up and tell me after. This paper started when I wrote about Josephine's mother and grandmother. And when you write about a woman, you just naturally begin to get interested in their children and in the lives of their children. And this happened with Josephine, and a year or two ago, I was wandering through the Bountiful Cemetery with a couple of the descendants of Josephine, and Sylvia and Patty, and they were telling some stories, and I got interested in the stories, and so I thought I would try doing a paper on the next generation. So with that introduction, we'll start here. For those of you who've read the Patty and Sylvia session, Sylvia chapter in my book, you'll know some of this background, but I'll go over it anyway. On February 8, 1844, Josephine Rosetta Lyon was born in the Mormon city of Nauvoo, Illinois, the daughter of Sylvia Sessions Lyon and possibly Windsor Lyon. As all three of their previous children had died while very young, they would have been grateful for the new arrival. Sylvia, the daughter of famous Mormon midwife Patty Sessions, had been the legal wife of Windsor since 1838. However, Sylvia married Joseph Smith polyandrously in May 1842, though still continuing to live with Windsor, and Josephine may have been Smith's child. But she grew up knowing nothing about her mother's celestial bond with Smith. Windsor Lyon was a well-to-do Mormon Nauvoo merchant who also happened to be excommunicant when Josephine was born. Josephine spent her first years in Nauvoo, probably surrounded by adoring Sessionses and Lyons. Joseph Smith, of course, was killed on June 27, 1844, so he may have held her in his arms as an infant, but she had no memories of him. Soon after Smith's death, in September 1844, Sylvia married Heber C. Kimball, the second man in Mormonism, polyandrously. As was customary in such marriages, she did not stop living with Windsor. We don't know many of the details of Josephine's upbringing, but we do know that her grandmother, Patty Sessions, was enormously hardworking. She was extremely generous with her resources. She was a close friend of Eliza R. Snow and much given to charismatic gifts of the Spirit. She was a gifted primitive writer and left a diary that is one of the masterpieces of Mormon literature that fortunately is now published and we can buy it. Sylvia is nowhere near as well documented as Patty, but the data we have indicates that she had many of her mother's virtues. In addition, it seems clear that both women were very attractive. So we can imagine Josephine growing up in the shadow of these striking personalities. and developing many of the same remarkable attributes herself. In the wake of the conflict with the Gentiles and the Mormon Exodus, the Lyons pained Patty Sessions when they decided not to come west with the Saints. Instead, Windsor apparently decided to pursue business opportunities with his brother Ethiel in Iowa City, Iowa. But before they left Nauvoo in late 1846, in January or February 1846, Windsor was rebaptized a Mormon with Heber C. Kimball performing the ordinance, surprisingly enough. So Josephine and the Lyons moved to Iowa. Two more Lyon children were born after Josephine, but both died as children. So Josephine had no living brothers or sisters from the Lyon family. In Iowa, Windsor apparently reached political and commercial prominence, only to be struck down by tuberculosis. His health was failing by 1848, and he died in January 1849. The only father that five-year-old Josephine knew was gone. Now occurs a sequence of events that I have always found extremely amusing. Sylvia was a widow, yet oddly enough still married to Heber C. Kimball. So she sent a letter to Heber and a letter to her brother Peregrine in Bountiful, Utah, and asked him to come take her to Utah. Peregrine obediently crossed the plains in the middle of winter, a grueling, freezing, time-consuming journey. When he arrived in Iowa City, however, Sylvia said, "Thanks for coming, brother, but I'm not going back with you. I'm getting married tonight." Peregrine wrote in his journal that this was one of the most difficult trials in his life. Furthermore, Sylvia was marrying a non-Mormon wealthy banker and businessman. A non-Mormon wealthy banker and businessman, Ezekiel Clark. But Sylvia had chosen her fourth husband and could not be dissuaded. With Ezekiel, she had three children who happily were healthy, a boy, Perry, 1851, and two girls, Phoebe Jane Clark, later Ellis, 1852, and Martha Sylvia Clark, later Burnham, who, by the way, was born in 1854 and lived to be 98, dying in 1952 in Bountiful. So Josephine finally had some siblings to grow up with. In addition, Ezekiel had three children from a previous marriage. From being an only child, Josephine had quickly become oldest sister in a large family. She was reportedly very close to Perry, nearest to her in age. However, Mormonism and her Mormon family were pulling Sylvia to Utah. When Peregrine passed through Iowa when returning from a mission to England in 1854, Sylvia arranged to go west with him on a visit, taking her four children along. Patty Sessions, now almost 60, wrote on August 2nd, "Went on, crossed Weber River, went to the mouth of Echo Canyon. There we met them, and a happy meeting it was. I had not seen my daughter for over 7 years. We wept for joy and rejoiced exceedingly. We then came, crossed the river, and camped." 10-year-old Josephine, who probably did not remember her grandmother, became acquainted with her for the first time. At the same time, she was introduced to the West and Zion in the mountains. In Utah, Josephine's mother was faced with a number of choices. And just to summarize, she decided she could not go back to Iowa, so she left Ezekiel. But she also did not live in one of the Heber C. Kimball plural homes. She decided to live out in Bountiful with her brother Peregrine. Ezekiel came to Utah and tried to convince her to return to Iowa, but she refused. However, she agreed to send Perry back to the East when he turned 9 to receive a thorough education, and Ezekiel, in later years, apparently visited and kept in touch with his two Utah daughters and helped them financially. On the other hand, Sylvia never lived in one of the... Okay, I can skip that. Sylvia continued to have a mind of her own. While she was thoroughly Mormon, she wasn't doctrinaire Mormon, as we can see by her marriage to the non-Mormon Clark. Though, of course, she, you know, was active in the Relief Society and Bountiful and so on. I now turn to a family history of Josephine written by Josephine Ekman Fisher, the wife of Josephine's son, Thomas. As a result of these events, Josephine grew to young womanhood in Bountiful, Utah. She first lived in a wide adobe house at modern 2nd West and 3rd North, where Josephine reportedly planted and tended towering box elder trees. But soon Sylvia moved to modern 5th West, at the time the gateway to Bountiful. Josephine Ekman wrote, "At one time Sylvia's was the only place where a visitor might obtain food and lodging. This kept everyone busy, especially Josephine, the oldest. One gets the impression that Sylvia was continuing her mother's enterprising spirit, and Josephine was always busy at work like her grandmother. Ekman notes that Josephine loved to visit Patty in Salt Lake, and we can document these visits in Patty's diary, beginning in 1855 when Josephine was 12. She would typically stay the night and accompany Patty in visiting friends, shopping, or doing errands in town. Sometimes she would stay with Patty when the older woman was sick. Often Josephine would come to Salt Lake with her mother or other Sessions relatives, such as Peregrine's son, Carlos. In 1860, when Josephine was 16, she went to a family celebration in the canyon on the 24th of July. Sometimes she would go to parties in Salt Lake or to the theater. In December 1861, Josephine stayed with Patty for a week, and they had photographs taken together. From March to July 1863, Josephine, now 19, boarded with her grandmother while attending school in Salt Lake. In the years before 1863, or in early 1863, Josephine began spending time with dashing, England-born John Fisher, 2 years older than her, who had been a Pony Express rider in 1860-61, which makes sense because that was the only time the Pony Express was working. But this was a dangerous but exciting job. Sylvia disapproved of John, thinking he was too wild for her daughter, but Josephine would meet him secretly in Salt Lake. Eventually, Sylvia must have bowed to the inevitable. On August 15, 1863, the 19-year-old Josephine married John, and they set up housekeeping on a farm at 630 West 10th North in West Bountiful. Soon they had two children, twins, and all the genealogy sheets said Ivan John, born August 30th, 1864, Irvin Frederick, born August 31st, 1864, and I thought it was a mistake, but every single one of those genealogy sheets had those different dates for those twins. And what happened was she had the one twin, and then she had a 12-hour labor and had the second twin. And that's recorded in Patty Sessions' journal. Wednesday, 1st of September, 1864, I went up to John Fisher's. Josephine was very sick. That's the code word for pregnant. Has got a pair of twins, both boys. One born last night, 6 o'clock. The other this morning, 3 o'clock. Patty and Josephine continued to visit each other throughout the rest of Patty's life, visits that would be made easier when Patty moved to Bountiful in 1872. Often after Patty paid a call to the Fisher home, quote, Johnny Fisher, unquote, would drive the venerable lady home. The boys were followed by two girls. The boys, the twins, were followed by two girls, Sylvia Jane, born in 1866, and Minnie Josephine, born in 1868. However, Josephine followed in the life experiences of her grandmother and mother in losing small children in heartbreaking ways. In February 1869, three of the children succumbed to diphtheria in the space of 5 days, leaving only 4-year-old Irvin surviving. In spring 1869, the Fishers left Utah to work a 120-acre ranch in Ruby Valley, Nevada, but they returned to Bountiful before long. They had more children in Bountiful, all of whom somehow my printout left something out here. Well, all of whom, and then my printout doesn't continue that thought. And then I had a list of the names, and some of them are left out. Well, anyway. The next page. Let's see if that's better. Yeah, all of whom would live to maturity. Great, okay. I knew I had something intelligent to finish that. Okay, so this is Perry Clark in 1870, Rosetta Linney, 1872, and that was her only daughter who would survive, William Erastus in 1874, Thomas Lyon, 1875, Kirkwood, 1877, and Horton Leo, in 1881. Those are birth dates. Horton lived until 1962, so he was the contemporary of many here. On April 11, 1878, Josephine, now 34, followed another life experience of her mother and grandmother when she became a plural wife. John married 18-year-old Harriet Knighton, a convert from England who had worked as a servant in the home. In this second family would be born 11 children, all born in Bountiful, except for one born in nearby Centerville. Harriet lived in a farmhouse not far from Josephine's in her later life. In spring 1882, Josephine's mother became very ill with dropsy, and Josephine and her Clark sisters undoubtedly tended her. At one point, Sylvia called Josephine to her bedside and told her that she, Sylvia, had been married to Joseph Smith, and that Josephine was actually the child of the prophet, which must have entirely astounded the young woman. Sylvia also cautioned her daughter not to make the fact generally known, which admonition Josephine followed. Sylvia died on April 13th at the age of 63. Later in 1882, in October, Josephine apparently moved to a larger home on 500 East and 500 South in Bountiful proper, but it's called East Bountiful in some records. Josephine's last child was born in 1881. Harriet's third was born in 1882. So we see that as the Fishers entered the 1880s, John was naturally paying extra attention to the younger family. At the same time, Mormonism had entered its worst decade of legal prosecution since Nauvoo, and the target was polygamist husbands. Cohabs were being sentenced to stiff terms in the Utah penitentiary, including some of the most prominent church leaders. So, to escape arrest, many Mormon polygamists joined the Underground Railroad and went into exile in Canada and Mexico. John Fisher, with two obvious families in Bountiful, was liable to prosecution. So by approximately 1885, he was forced to join the underground, to the dismay of his wives and children. Family anecdotes record his narrow escapes from marshals, and in addition affirm that Josephine repeatedly was brought before a judge to answer questions about John's whereabouts. We now approach a dramatic moment in Josephine's story. I rely on oral traditions from one side of the family here, so if anyone from the other side would like to talk to me later, I'd be delighted to meet them. This is a work in progress, not final. Nevertheless, a story told from a particular point of view still has validity and interest. According to this family tradition, Harriet approached Josephine at about this time to talk over the problem. She pointed out that she had a large young family and that John was going to have to leave soon. But she said there could be a solution to the dilemma that could be simple. Josephine could go to the Davis County Courthouse and get a divorce. This would allow Harriet to marry John legally, and the prosecution and constant harrying of the marshals would end. Of course, Harriet said John's relationship with his first family would stay the same. Josephine thought the plan over, presumably talked it over with John, and then with typical generosity agreed to the separation. Josephine went to court, obtained the divorce on June 30, 1888. John then married Harriet legally. I should mention, however, that in some versions of this story, Josephine thought of the divorce and carried it out entirely by herself. However, according to the family tradition I'm following, at this point, John began giving his new legal family much more attention than Josephine and his first family. In addition, the Edmonds and Edmund Tucker laws may have made it necessary for him not to visit his first family. As can be imagined, this caused tensions between the two families. According to this tradition, Harriet had engineered the divorce intentionally and had taken advantage of the more naive, trusting Josephine. Harriet obtained a copy of the divorce notice in the paper and saved it carefully. Her boys, who had been part of a second family, and often in Mormon culture that was down on the totem pole, they now began emphasizing that they were the primary family. Josephine and her six sons remained in their home, scraping out a living with their part of the farm, feeling some tension at their treatment by their father and members of the second Fisher family. Josephine Ekman Fisher describes the constant labor in Josephine's household. Quote, "The boys arose in the wee small hours to load and drive to the market in Salt Lake City, where the produce was sold in quantity or peddled from house to house. For Bountiful was a city of market gardeners. Later, there was no end to the luscious fruit, apricots, pears, cherries, and apples to be gathered and marketed. Always there was the inevitable irrigation to be taken care of. Every day, cows must be milked. Horses, cows, and pigs must be fed. For the women, too, there was no end of work, as they bottled and dried fruit and tended to dairy products. Though all worked so hard, there was not so much money to be made on the farm or in the city. It was equally difficult." End of quote. An incident recorded in John Fisher's journal shows the tensions between the two families. As the story was told to me, one day, Josephine and her sons were hard at work on their part of the farm when John paid a surprise visit, driving up in a wagon. Josephine and her boys gathered to see what he had to say. "Well, Josephine," he said, "I'm sorry, but I need the boys to work up at the ranch this summer." Apparently, he had started a new enterprise in the mountains and needed workers to help him clear it off. This, of course, would have left Josephine without her farm workers. Josephine asked, "Well, John, what do you expect me to do?" So, evidently, Josephine and her sons talked it over, and then I believe it was Irvin, the oldest, spoke to the father, and he communicated that they would not go with him, they would stay and work with Josephine. So the Fisher boys stayed loyal to their mother in this situation. So there was tension between the two families and with John. Nevertheless, a descendant of Josephine tells me that even though there was this tension, they continued to stay together as a family, and that John continued to love the children in his first family. He supported his sons on missions and wrote them letters in the mission field. John became a very prominent leader in Bountiful politics, serving as mayor twice, and was a member of the territorial legislature. He was also a notary republic, justice of the peace, and justice of the probate court. On a cultural level, he helped organize and manage the People's Opera House and Mercantile Company of Bountiful. It's kind of a strange combination there, Opera House and Mercantile. On an ecclesiastical level, he served as first counselor in the first bishopric in West Bountiful in 1877. On December 14, 1892, Patty Sessions died, and another link with Josephine's heritage was gone. She herself was now 48. On the other hand, she soon began acquiring daughters-in-law and a son-in-law. Irvin married Lydia Eliza Jones in 1894. Perry exchanged vows with Della Ann Harrison in 1893. Rosetta entered matrimony with Edwin Ludwig Hansen in 1897. And Thomas was united with Josephine Ekman, the author of the biography I've been quoting, in 1901. Finally, Horton Leo married Martha Ann Stoker in 1903. However, Kirkwood died in 1899 in an agricultural accident. To the best of my understanding, as I was told this story, while he was hiring out to a farmer in Woodruff, Rich County, up north, he was climbing up some kind of mechanism connected with a hay machine, lost his footing, and fell some 30 or 40 feet to the ground. He lingered a few hours, then died of severe internal injuries. So this must have been a very tragic experience for Josephine. We may pause here as Josephine enters the grandmotherly period of her life and trace some general outlines of her personality. Josephine Ekman described her as an extremely sympathetic mother-in-law. Quote, if a son of hers made a complaint against his wife, he was quietly reminded of the wife's good qualities. Presently, his troubles seemed minimized and he left in a happy mood. End quote. Josephine E. also leaves a testimony to Josephine's love of flowers. She called her the little flower lady, and to her enormous generosity and industry. Quote, in her old-fashioned garden, there seemed to be every kind of flower that grows. She was so fond of them and was noted for her generosity in sharing them. She loved to please a friend or brighten a sick room. For a party or a funeral, she was always ready with a big bouquet. To keep her flowers blooming for many years, she carried pails and pails of water from nearby Barton Creek. It was a happy day when the city supplied a hydrant and she could use a hose. Josephine Rosetta's son, Thomas, wrote, quote, my mother was always working, always wanting to help those in need. We had many poor neighbors and friends. Mother loved them all and made them welcome at home. She visited them often, usually with a bundle in her hand. This sounds like a reincarnation of her grandmother, Patty Sessions, herself, and probably reflected Sylvia's liberality and warmth also. A granddaughter recalls a certain peculiar trait. Josephine always wore three or four petticoats. She wouldn't give them up even when she was working. We close this section with two more deaths. John Fisher, after an active business and political life, died on October 23rd, 1905, after suffering from heart disease for about 2 years. He was 63. We imagine Josephine grieving for him and typically forgiving him for anything at the end of his life. On November 9th, 1914, Josephine's only surviving daughter, Rose, died prematurely at the age of 42 from placenta pollevia childbirth after giving birth to 9 previous children. Josephine may have been at Rose's side at the tragic death, which must have been very difficult for her. So of Josephine's 10 children, she lost 5 before her own death. Early the next year, on February 24th, assistant church historian Andrew Jensen, an important pioneer in documenting Joseph Smith's plural wives, visited Bountiful and at his request, Josephine, now 71, signed the affidavit affirming that her mother had told her on her deathbed that she, Josephine, was Joseph Smith's daughter. This meeting presumably took place at Josephine's Bountiful home. Also present and signing the affidavit as witnesses were Josephine's oldest child, Irvin Frederick, and local Bountiful stake president, Joseph Hiram Grant, my own great-grandfather. General authorities had known about this connection for some time, and Angus Cannon, brother of George Q. Cannon and longtime president of Salt Lake City Stake, had used the information in trying to convince Joseph Smith III that Joseph Smith Jr. had been a polygamist. Joseph F. Smith would invite Josephine to Smith family reunions held at each summer in Salt Lake. In her later life, her granddaughter remembers, Josephine became extremely devoted to taking patent medicines. However, death finally claimed her on May 30, 1924, when she was 80 in Salt Lake City, where she was staying at the home of Thomas and Josephine Ekman Fisher. Her body stopped working, a descendant writes, probably partly from taking too much medicine. Her obituary says that she died of general debility. Quote, she was not sick at all, being able to get about the house to the last, end quote. Josephine was buried in Bountiful beside her mother and grandmother. It is striking that all three women, the first two married multiple times and all with large families, were not buried near their husbands. I now return to Josephine's life, especially the story of her divorce, to try to apply a feminist analysis of points of sorts. I think every thoughtful, moral human being who believes in the Christian principles of social justice has to be a feminist. The question is, what type of feminism? There are many kinds, and they vary on specific issues. My peculiar bias or bent or limitation is to avoid the extremes, even though one can sympathize with the reason some people go to extremes. For instance, a woman who has been abused by a father might feel emotionally that all men are evil. A feminist historian reading the documents of ages and cultures with much less sensitivity to women's issues than ours has can easily become Gnostic in the sense of seeing all men as patriarchal, forceful, controlling, and women nurturing and kind as pure victims. Men are absolutely evil, women absolutely good. However, history and reality have great complexity, in fact, infinite complexity. Even though political views are necessary, we find good people on the wrong side of issues and bad people on the right side of issues. We find oppressed people who work against their own cause and oppressors with sincere humanitarian sides. People on the quote-unquote right side of the issue battle among themselves. Great humanitarian leaders have stupid, destructive affairs. So, in interpreting history, we often do not find strictly schematic political morality plays. For instance, in the story of Josephine's divorce, following the tradition I use above, Josephine certainly wears the white hat, but John temporarily appears somewhat unsympathetic. But the black hat is worn by another woman, Harriet. John follows Harriet. One might pursue a sympathetic interpretation of why Harriet caused or influenced Josephine to get a divorce. Her story might show how insecure a second wife felt in polygamy. In addition, she may have acted as she did to secure a better life for her children. Still, to the extent that she furthered her family at the expense of Josephine's, her actions hurt another woman. In the confrontation on Josephine's farm, one might focus on John's insensitivity to his wife's needs, but if we were trying to pursue a strict male evil, woman good interpretation, it would be flawed because Josephine's 5 boys, males, rallied around her. Their rejection of the father was a strikingly anti-patriarchal action proceeding from a male against another male. It is remarkable because it is the sons rebuking the father in support of the mother. In addition, Josephine and her mother and grandmother, all of them, showed keenly independent minds in their choices of husbands. Josephine opposed her mother to marry John. So here we have a woman versus woman conflict over the issue of the younger woman's decision to forge a new independent relationship, male-female. We might remember Sylvia's independence of mind in marrying non-Mormon Ezekiel Clark after she dragged her brother Peregrine all the way across the plains in the winter. And Patty Sessions, as a teenager, had married David Sessions against her mother's and father's wishes. So that tradition went on through the three generations. My conclusion as a historian is that we certainly should have political moral views. Nothing in this life can be done in a moral vacuum. There is no such thing as purely objective, unbiased history. All history writing must have an overarching purpose, which must have a moral dimension, however subtle and indirect it might be. But we must be wary that we do not allow our political moral views to oversimplify the complexity of human reality as it is reflected in the historical record. My conclusion as a feminist is that the totality of the historical record will lead us to develop a moderate feminism, one that firmly seeks to complete equality in our culture, but that rejects a Gnostic, strictly polarized sexual equation. Thank you.
I think you'll all agree with me that we have the privilege of hearing from a very talented young Mormon scholar and author, as we've heard from Todd Compton today. It was my pleasure to read his paper, and it's my pleasure to comment on it just a bit. And I really don't have a lot of critical comment to offer. I just sat back and in paper when I read it and enjoyed it again when I heard it from him. I have to say that part of his success, I think, is attributable to choosing a very good and interesting subject. What we have here is the fourth generation writing about three generations of very interesting, strong women. And I love to hear about the strong women in the LDS tradition, in the Mormon tradition. We've heard quite a bit about Patty Sessions and her wonderful journals that give us so much insight about life in Nauvoo, the life of a woman, what it's like coming across the plains, and then in the early Utah Territory. Patty Sessions' descendants, however, are in many ways as interesting as she is, and we're not so rich in having journals that are as good as the ones that Patty left us, but we do have some fascinating insights in these other two generations. It's too bad they didn't tell us more about themselves. I was also fascinated by John Fisher. I like these rabble-rousers, these frontier guys that are rough-and-ready types, these cowboys and Pony Express riders and people like John Fisher was. I think he must have been quite an entrepreneur, quite a pioneer in his own right, and he might be a subject for another paper somewhere down the line. I was quite interested in Josephine's marriage, or I shouldn't say marriage, her divorce of convenience. We talk about marriage of convenience. This was certainly a divorce of convenience. And it brought to mind the ease of divorce in Utah Territory at this time. It was one of the easiest places in the United States where a divorce could be procured, and I thought about a Utah Law Review article talking about how people would travel on the Transcontinental Railway till they got to Corinne, and they actually had vending machines that would give you the papers for a divorce, and you could write them out right there and deposit them there in the Corinne train station and then go back east, and you'd have a valid divorce in Utah Territory. But I thought that this was a very nice solution to a very ugly, thorny problem, a divorce of convenience. One thing that Todd talks about is he uses the term disinheritance, and I think it kind of, he does that a little bit loosely, taking it from a legal perspective and, you know, thinking like a lawyer sometimes, which I try to divorce myself from, is that I was curious about just what he meant by disinheritance, and I think he's talking about the second family sort of being neglected after the divorce, but it made me kind of curious about how the property, there seemed to be quite a lot of property there, farms and so on, and houses, and how that property was disposed of at the divorce, and also at his death. And he preceded, John preceded Josephine in his death by about 19 years. Perhaps John turned more attention to Harriet and her family precisely because of Josephine's independence and her ability to care for her children and her maturity, which might have been less so with the older family. I think that in so many senses, 19th century Mormon women epitomized the ideals of feminism. I think that that's the kind of feminism, and John talks or Todd talks about a middle of the road, a less extreme type of feminism, as opposed to what I think of as what Lori Johnson calls the feminites. These weren't feminites; these were feminists. I'd also like to see more, and Todd alludes to this about. The opposing side of the story, as told by Harriet's descendants, I think that would be interesting. He did leave a little something out that I enjoyed in the original paper that he sent to me. Some mention was made that before Josephine's death, that she very much enjoyed imbibing of Lydia Pinkham's organic tonic, and talked about how that had been advertised in the Davis County Clipper, which still publishes, by the way. And that this tonic was about 19% alcohol. And I also thought that it was a little ironic that all through her life, Josephine carried that Josephine name and didn't really suspect until very late in life and until she was told that she was indeed a child of Joseph Smith. And, you know, how true that is, we don't know, but there's a pretty good possibility that her namesake is Joseph himself. One other thing that I would like to see, that this comes from the librarian side of my psyche, is that I'd like to see more citation to sources, even right in the text. I know an awful lot came out of Joseph Ackerman Fisher's biography, but I'd like to see reference to the specific people who gave the oral history and the family traditions and so on, and maybe if not in the text itself, that we could sort of J. Michael Quinnize it a little bit and put them all in the footnotes. Okay. Well, that's about all I have to say, other than I was very pleased to see this paper, and I'm very pleased that there's scholarship and investigation into the life of the 19th century women's contribution to pioneering in the development of Mormonism. Thank you very much.
We have about 20 minutes. Todd, I don't know if you want to respond to any of Lee's remarks and then maybe field some questions from the audience.
I think, thanks, Lee, for those thoughtful comments. But I think you made the mistake of actually reading what I sent you, you know, because I was editing almost as I read. And I think I did not use, I'm not sure, you know, we'll have to listen to the tape, but I know I tried not to use the word disinherited as much. I might not have used it at all. But it does bring up an interesting question that I know nothing about, and that is, what happened when John Fisher died legally, who inherited what. That would be very interesting, and if there are people here who know something about that, I would be interested in having them tell us or talk to me later. Yes. Or stand up, or...
Years ago, I had information given to me. Someone in the Fisher family had the seer stone that John Smith had that was supposed to have been from Joseph Smith. Do you have any information on that?
I have absolutely no information on that. So, once again, if anyone has further, I'd be interested to hear it.
Todd, I just had a comment. I wondered if you left out the Lydia Pinkham part because there were too many Fishers in the audience today.
I was, you know, partially just editing for time. There's a big footnote there, as you know. No one else knew. But that was funny because when I read that in an interview with, I think, one of her granddaughters, and I had no idea what Lydia Pinkham meant, and I went to the Utah State Historical Society, and sitting out there on the shelf was a whole book about Lydia Pinkham. And so it was very, very popular in early 1900s, late 1800s. And it was called Lydia Pinkham's Vegetable Compound. And a scientific test was done on it by, you know, the British Medical Society, and they said they discovered very little vegetable substance. But it was the advertisements are very interesting, and I went into the Bountiful Clipper and found a number of advertisements for it, and you have testimonials by women who took it. And it was taken for female complaints, womb trouble, derangement of the uterus, exhaustion, even insanity. I remember in one advertisement, a man said that his wife had attacked him, you know, out of insanity, and after she took Lydia Pinkham's, it solved all her problems, and it never happened again. But it's an interesting aspect of the culture at that time, kind of turn of the century. I'm also doing work on Helen Marr Whitney, Kimball Whitney, and she was fascinated by all kinds of patent medicines that seemed very strange to us, but it was part of the culture back then. And they didn't have the kind of medical controls that we have now. The kind of medical controls that we have now were just beginning to take place. And so anyone could put out any kind of medicine, and if you had a good advertising campaign, you could make a lot of money. So there's a whole book about Lydia Pinkham's if you're interested in that. Yes? Okay, well, there's a question about the RLDS denial that Joseph Smith had any plural wives. It's a really interesting, long question. I could give you the short answer, the long answer, the really long answer. The early RLDS church was, there were a lot of people in it who had known Joseph Smith in Nauvoo and known he practiced polygamy and had actually protested against the polygamy, and I think especially of William Marks. However, when Joseph Smith III became the president of the church, he was influenced by Emma, and they wanted to not let it be known in any way that Joseph Smith had practiced polygamy. Emma certainly knew. Recent RLDS church, many of them are quite liberal, you know, good historians, and they have accepted that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy. But there is one breakoff, very conservative breakoff of the RLDS church, and they still totally deny it. So it's an interesting question. No, she didn't really leave him. There were tensions between them because of the polygamous wives. There's a lot. There's some of this in my book, but even better would be Mormon Enigma, more centered on Emma. Mormon Enigma by Linda King Newell and Feline Tippetts Avery. In the back. But it was very common. I mean, everyone was taking these things all through America. It was nothing uncommon for. Yeah. Yeah, okay. First of all, let me mention, it didn't get on the mic, but George says that there is actually still a Lydia Pinkham store back in, what was it, Massachusetts someplace? And, okay, he also asked about when Sylvia told Josephine that she was a child of Joseph Smith, whether there's any evidence that there were any other children that Sylvia knew about. And I don't know of any evidence that she told Josephine anything like that. Mary Elizabeth Rollins Leitner did say that she knew of three or four children of Joseph Smith raised under other names, but she didn't give any specifics. So,
sure. Having had the benefit of reading all the footnotes, another thing that I believe in footnotes that is enlightening here is that the Smith family itself recognized her as a Smith child, that Joseph Fielding Smith had invited her to the family reunions all along.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes? This gentleman, yes? Says one of the slogans with Lydia Pinkham was a baby in every bottle. Interesting. Okay, yes?
Concerning the Sears store, I've dug about 1,000 feet of dips this summer. Found that there's no shortage of rocks in Utah. I'm sure with the proper amount of faith, a person could probably come up with one. I have a question about polygamy. I think this came up in connection with your book in someone else's session yesterday. It seemed like someone said that with Joseph Smith's plural wives, there were very few children. And I was raised on the idea that the purpose of polygamy had something to do with the shortage of men. And we know that another purpose of marriage is to produce families, children. And with so much about polygamy, I need to go back to the beginning and ask for clarification.
Okay, the question is, what really was the purpose of polygamy? Was it shortage of men, need for children? That's a big question. At the risk of looking like I'm trying to sell my book, my first chapter deals with that. It's very hard to give a short answer to it, but I believe definitely the purpose was theological, and it had nothing to do with there were too many men, too few women, or too many women, too many unattached women. It had nothing to do with that. It was theological. I think that was connected. It was connected with the whole idea of eternal marriage, eternal seed through marriage, and also on earth of more people coming in through your line. So it was connected with those ideas. Yes?
The question changed when you really look at it. That just thought about polyandry is what he was involved with, along with polygamy. But there are issues. I mean, that changes the question. So it changed when Brigham Young came on the scene. But you know, we shy away from that, and we always go back to polygamy. But that isn't what Joseph Smith was practicing. He was practicing marrying women that were married. And that's where the answers change if you look at it that way.
This woman said something about there was a change from what Joseph Smith was practicing to what later Mormon polygamists were practicing, and Joseph Smith practiced polyandry as well as polygamy. Yes, but I do think that his ideas, you know, his theological reasons for polygamy continued on through Mormonism, even though polyandry didn't continue in Mormonism. Yes?
I think he was talking about theology. He was on very shaky ground. He was at odds with the Book of Mormon. I don't know if you're familiar with the foundation stone in that mansion house. He made a copy of the 1830 original Book of Mormon.
Who's he?
Joseph Smith. There are 1,300 changes to that copy. And one of the things he laid along with the Book of Mormon was this note. This thing, referring to the Book of Mormon, has been a problem or trouble to me all my life. And he tried to overturn some of the things in the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants. Especially, it's very obvious if you compare the Book of Commandments to the Doctrine and Covenants.
Excuse me, don't let me interrupt you, but, you know, that's really off the subject at this point.
Well, I was going to say, in the Book of Jacob, it talks about crime, and then it says, a grosser crime than pride is polygamy.
Okay, well, again, it's off the subject, but I think the Book of Mormon, it leaves a way open for practicing polygamy. Yeah, okay, well, Book of Mormon is kind of off the subject, but, yeah.
And the Doctrine and Covenants tells Joseph Smith that he is to have polygamy, and he's condemned by God because he didn't do it when he was supposed to, and I think he was afraid of Emma. But anyway, he was told, and also he was told, the Lord said, if I tell you to do it, then you do it. But he said it was all right for David and Solomon because he told them to. And that if they were commanded to do it, and you say, why polygamy? Well, look at the church now had to have a strong base to build the church on, and it had to have, and they didn't have much time. They only had 10 years, and all this came up. Brigham Young said, if you'll give me 10 years. And so that's the basis of our church today. But when the Lord orders it, he has reasons, and he did for David and Solomon for the same reason, to build up the children of Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I totally agree.
And they did it because they were told to. Joseph Smith didn't want to. And the Lord condemns him because he didn't.
Right, and who was it Brigham Young said when he was told about polygamy and he saw a coffin go by, he wanted to trade places with the guy in the coffin. It was very difficult for all the early Mormons. And I agree, as you said, there were, you know, he believed that God commanded him to, and we have DNC 132 that talks about that. Well, later in Utah, sometimes men did marry widows, you know, but early in the church, the motivation was very much theological, I think.
Todd, if we could, back to Josephine for a moment. Could you comment in your research on any other corroborative evidence or history that you may have found concerning Josephine's the ascendancy from the prophet Joseph Smith, in addition to the affidavit we have, and in addition to perhaps the recognition of the Smith family. Anything else that...
Okay. I mentioned Angus Cannon. Angus Cannon left a statement. It's in the church archives. And he said that he went and talked to Joseph Smith III. Here we have the RLDS Church connection. And he was trying to convince him, Joseph Smith Jr., the father of Joseph Smith III, had been a polygamist. And he brought up, you know, we have in Bountiful, near Salt Lake, we have Patty Sessions' granddaughter is a child of Joseph Smith. And some people ask, why wasn't... And so we have Angus Cannon, who was the brother, you know, very conservative, the brother of George Q. Cannon, and he was using this to argue with the RLDS that there were children in Joseph Smith's polygamy. Some people have asked, why wasn't this emphasized even more? And I think because of the problematic nature of the polyandrous relationships, it was not mentioned more. But Angus Cannon is another example. And I should mention, I mentioned in the earlier session I had, all history is ambiguous. We could still interpret some people could interpret the affidavit of Josephine Fisher as Josephine misunderstood her mother and she was only a spiritual child of Joseph Smith. No, I think that's a very possible way of interpreting it. But myself, I've convinced that they put enough emphasis on getting that affidavit that I think that they're talking about a literal child. In the back, Jess? You know, that's funny. There's a picture of her in my book and other places, and it's interesting because often daughters do not look like their fathers completely. They look a lot like their mothers often. But you could compare Joseph Smith and Josephine and see how they compare. Way in the corner here.
I'm wondering if Josephine knew that her grandmother, Patty Sessions, was also a wife of Joseph Smith, because I think that's so interesting, the fact that both Sylvia and Patty were wives. I'm just wondering, you know, to what extent that affected Josephine's life, or if she, you know, if it was an item or not.
You know, I really don't know if she knew that Patty had been connected with Joseph Smith. Patty wrote it in her journal. I don't think she kept it secret. Because she wrote it openly in her journal, and of course I don't know if she shared her journal with anyone. I just don't know. It would be nice to know at some point. Since you're close, I'll let you speak.
Okay, I would think that Josephine herself might have figured that out sometimes. You know, they don't just sit there. They think about things, you know, even when she was small, maybe, and then there are always... people saying, oh, doesn't she look like so-and-so, and doesn't she look like so-and-so? I imagine that she might even guessed or figured it out earlier.
Who knows?
Interesting thing. Yes?
DNA testing.
A lot of people have, but I haven't tried to push it in any way. If anyone wants to pursue it, that's fine with me. He asked about if anyone had tried DNA testing to see if Josephine actually was daughter of Joseph Smith. Nadine, yes.
Well, I have a comment and a question. My comment is...
Would you like to speak into the phone?
I it's not that important.
Okay.
My grandma took Lady Pinkham, and she told me about the baby in every bottle, and she would be shocked if she knew that it was 25% alcohol.
19.
Oh, 19. Yeah. Even that much. But my question is, have in looking at whether Josephine was Joseph's daughter, have you looked at what was going on in his life 9 months before she was born, and is that reasonably possible that she was
You know, that would be the logical thing to do, which explains why I've never done it. You know, that'll be fun to look at. I just assumed he was in Nauvoo, Sylvia was in Nauvoo. I mean, Joseph was in Nauvoo. Oh, I'm sorry. She asked if I'd checked to see where Joseph Smith was 9 months before. But there is a possibility that he might have been out of town for some reason. So we could pursue that. Thanks.
But Josephine was born in Nauvoo.
Yeah.
Josephine mm-hmm. was born in Nauvoo.
Yeah, Josephine was born in Nauvoo.
Well,
yeah. They were all in Nauvoo, you know, in 1843. But that's the thing. I don't know month to month if, you know, where Joseph Smith was. Was it March? No, February, I think. February 8th.
I've worked with Todd on this a little bit, this investigation of Josephine and her relationship to Joseph Smith. And it appears that, first of all, Sylvia was part of a social circle in Nauvoo that Joseph Smith was obviously very much a part of. There was sort of a social elite there. So Josephine's mother was part of that, and of course she was sealed to Joseph Smith, and at the time that she could have been conceived, her legal husband, Windsor, was out of favor with the church. He was the pharmacist in Nauvoo, and he built the first commercial building there. So they interacted periodically. Joseph Smith would show up at Sylvia's home periodically for business or church or for social reasons, and there was a lot of interaction. Windsor, by the way, Sylvia's husband, was reinstated in the church shortly thereafter. The disagreement was over a financial matter, and it was not really Windsor's fault. So there was a lot of interaction, generally speaking. So it was very possible. Everything pointed to the possibility of it. And I might point out one other thing too here, that we have Josephine's, at least we have her granddaughter here today, and she lived with Josephine. There are two of you? Two of Josephine's granddaughters, and I know that Norma here lived with Josephine as a teenager. So that just for interest, and if anyone wishes to discuss that afterwards, they're welcome to.
This is really odd for me because I'm used to dealing with women who've been gone a long time, so this is wonderful we have people here who actually knew her. Okay, one last question. Oh, we have... Let's let this one speak, okay?
Yes, on your report, after Josephine and John Fisher got married, they went to Ruby Valley to homestead. And that was part of their problem because Harriet came to help them as a maid, and Josephine didn't want to stay there too long. She wanted to get back to Bountiful, and that caused some repercussions.
That's very interesting. Do we have one last question? Okay, one last question, that'll be it. Oh, was that you, Jess, back then?
Well, it's not okay, but I'll another time.
Okay.
Thesis about pseudo-polyandry, that the women that Joseph Smith married were either in relationship to him or some other man, if there was a, in terms of marital relationship. And he only married women who were estranged versus not.
Jess Grosbeck, there goes his anonymity, has asked if I'd had occasion to have disagreements with Andy Ehat and his ideas on pseudo-polyandry. I haven't been able to get hold of a copy of that paper. I was there when he gave it, and so I can't disagree as to the total details, but as I understand it, I think I take a different tack than he took. I don't see it as she was really married to one man and this other marriage wasn't really a marriage. I see it that they were both marriages. You know, there are different types of marriages, but they were both marriages. So I don't use that term pseudo-polyandry. Thanks, and especially thanks to the descendants who came today.